This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Screen Talk. I'm Eric Cohn.
And I'm Ann Thompson.
And we've got a ton to discuss, Ann, from the WGA strike to some big changes in Oscar season. But perhaps the most important item that we have to get into at the top of the hour is obviously the Met Gala, because that red carpet,
this is the most important thing that's happened in the culture.
That the entertainment world.
All year.
Big stuff. Did you see that cockroach? My God.
Oh my God, it flew. You could tell that the photographer that was photographing the cockroach, they were all waiting for Rihanna to show up. That was part of what was going on at that point. She was very late and there was nothing else to do except make a fuss about the cockroach. But you could tell that the photographer was tempted to squish it at some,
yes,
you know, and
he
backed off.
That.
And some other guy eventually put his heel down.
Yeah. No, that was some expert party reporting that got out. I don't know if it was Variety or somebody who got
Mark Malkin really did his best there. And he was also asking a lot of the people on the red carpet for their response to the Writers Guild strike, which was, and they used that in Variety reporting on the strike. So that
yeah,
was
you got to get these things where
it wasn't
you can.
All lightweight, you know.
I was thinking a bit about how, you know, I think it was a year or so ago in the Oscars, the Academy was saying they were going to try to use the Met Gala as sort of a template of sorts for the Oscars. But the truth is the Met Gala is, I mean, nobody cares about the event that they're actually going to. It's just the carpet. It's so built around, like, everybody stopped watching, you know. It's not like,
but it's also an economical ecosystem of its own in terms of all the donated fashion. You know, everybody's got an angle. Everybody's promoting a house. You know, there's an enormous,
it's a philanthropic endeavor
invested in each of these outfits. Of course, Jared Leto was, he won the night with his Chopette cat.
Yeah, and then a quick costume change too. It's not like he was going to stay in that. It looked kind of hot, but that was funny. I mean, the thing is, it was funny when the cat was there because it was like everybody thought the real Karl Lagerfeld cat was going to come, right? He left all his fortune to this poor animal, and then this cat is there. And then when he took his hat off and he revealed himself as Jared Leto, I was like, is this good or bad for Jared Leto? Like, are people just going to make fun of him for this, or does it just?
He won the evening. I mean, he took. I mean, Janelle Monáe, you know, was absolutely in there too, with her layered look. That
I don't know, Lil Nas X
off of her, you know.
Lil Nas X was basically naked in silver sequins or something
with that a thong.
It looked like a thong.
And Florence Pugh's head was naked. She shaved it and had this beautiful gown and this headdress that stood straight up, you know, incredibly far, but she looked great. She had her head. Some people look good with a shaved head.
Yeah. It was sort of like the midsummer as a fashion statement or something, like the next evolved state of all that. I do think it's funny that, you know, it's enjoyable. I'm not a very fashion forward person. I don't know if you can tell, but I enjoyed watching it. I mean, there's something about that, the idea of just live streaming fashion on a red carpet, that is very much, you know, of the moment. It's
a kind of performance art when they do it right. I mean, you know, David Byrne shows up on a bicycle, right? You know, so everybody's inside, you know, there. Some people have a lot of fun with it. I mean, if Jessica Chastain shows up in a blonde, you know, all blonde with a Lagerfeld set of shades, you know, that's
while she's on Broadway, she was just nominated for a Tony for Dolls.
It was a Monday. She could, and she has something to promote, her Tony award. Absolutely right.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting.
Celebrities. It's not just movies and film. It's sports.
It's everything. Exactly. That's very of the moment.
And very New York.
It's all kind of blended together, and there's no narrative arc. There's no stakes. or anything. It's just exactly what you're looking at in the moment. And that was kind of fascinating. So, hey, if this writer's strike goes on, they could probably use some more red carpets to stay in the public eye, because who knows how things are going to get disrupted.
I was just glad that Billie Eilish revealed that she had a figure and a forehead. Yeah, she
not everyone was hidden away.
Her look, you know.
Yeah,
you know, it was great. And Pedro Pascal wore shorts, so that was a moment.
That's hilarious. A nice sort of sneak peek of
keeping his fashion thing going. He's not.
Yeah. Sweating. Well, you know, look, the most recent way people have been seeing Pedro Pascal is behind the mask of the Mandalorian. So he needs to kind of remind people that there's a person there just ahead of his.
He's out and about. There's no. Well, there's no hiding Pedro Pascal.
It's a sneak peek of whatever might happen at Cannes when he goes as part of the Pedro Almodovar short and the
can't
the,
wait to see that Western with Ethan Hawke. Yeah. No. The other great reveal was Anna Wintour and Bill Nighy as a couple. You know, on the record. So there have been rumors that they've been dating for years.
And they came up again in the Oscar campaign for Bill Nighy.
And so the whole question is, are they or aren't they? And they finally denied that they're dating, that they're just old friends.
So this was essentially like a performance.
I was crushed by this. Crushed.
Yeah. I mean, who knows what even is friendship these days? It can take a lot of different forms. So anyway, why don't we talk about the strike? Because, you know, okay. We can't just do fashion the whole time, as fun as that might be. We'll come back to that eventually.
The writer's strike is a serious thing.
Happening.
I was around for the last one and the one before that. And I can attest that they take, you know, what you're seeing right now with all the rallies and the signs and everybody getting all excited is absolutely par for the course, you know, normal. And when you see the studios sort of say, hey, we can hang in, we can last, you know, we're not going to hurt. That's also par for the course. This is the back and forth that goes on until they sit down. Nothing's going to happen. And the way that they broke apart in the negotiations on the night of the deadline, there were so many issues left unresolved that it's going to take a really long time, because they have to rebuild the whole thing. Because of the streamers, because of the changes in the industry.
The whole system.
The old deal that they had is no longer extant. It just doesn't work anymore.
I was just starting out, sort of a young, new freelance journalist of sorts when the last strike happened, and got sent to cover picket lines and talk to people like, you know, oh, there's Tim Robbins. I'm going to go ask him about what's on the line. And it was a pretty straightforward set of demands compared to the kind of landscape that we're dealing with now, where it's like being a freelance writer in Hollywood and a gig economy. All these people are talking about how they have to like drive Uber and stuff like that to supplement their income, not just because of, you know, the lack of residuals on a lot of streaming shows, but because the contracts are so short. You can't even have like a sustainable career for a long period of time on a big show.
It used to be that on a network show, you could have, you know, 20 episodes, you know, these seasons that went on for a really long time and had residuals, and you would make a lot of money. You would make money in between jobs. Now you have these 6 and 7 and 8 and 10 episode arcs. And if you're working for a streamer, there's no residuals. Yeah. You know, the residuals are tiny. And what they're really talking about with the gig economy are the emerging, rising young writers. It's about how you learn how to become a writer, and how do you get on a writer's room, and also these mini rooms, which you know, they put them up together at the beginning before they've even ordered a pilot, before they've ordered anything. And they arc out they map out the arcs of the season with this small group of people who may not even get hired and move on. And it's you can't make a living on those either. But the other thing that happens is that those people never get to be on set. They never get to learn what goes on, you know, during production. And that's part of the education of a writer. So there's a lot of issues at stake here.
Yeah. And the other part of it is that everyone knows there's plenty of money being thrown around at the studios. Top executive salaries have been public. So when you see that people are making, you know, tens of millions of dollars, you know, the sense that, you know,
or hundreds of millions in the case
in
of
some
Zaslav.
Cases. Yeah. And David Zaslav. So it's like, what they're asking for, if you really crunch the numbers, doesn't seem like that much. It's just that the studio doesn't want to build its business model around what they're asking for. So
well, one of the sticking points that I see very clearly is that they're asking for guaranteed number of writers in a room and a guaranteed length of time. And that is where the studios are really balking. And I can understand that because they don't want to pay for something that they don't need. And there are a lot of shows where a single writer like a Peter Morgan, you know, writes the whole thing for the Crown. You know, he doesn't have the usual writer's room, and they want to leave showrunners in charge of how many writers they actually need. I did an interview recently with Ryan Condal of House of the Dragon. He started with 7 writers, and then in season 2, he only needed 5. So it wasn't like he was cheaping out or trying to save money or anything. It was what he needed.
So well, this is the whole thing with the economics of doing union projects in general. A lot of times, like you look at like ultra low budget projects that are non-union, and it's like, well, they had to be non-union to be ultra low budget, because once you're working with union guidelines, there's this cost baked into that. And you know, these capitalist models just are not built around the idea that you spend money unless you have like a specific return on that investment in mind. But there's gonna have to be, I mean, these people cannot stay on strike forever. The studios cannot just have no new product. So there's going to be something that will have to change.
It's going to hurt is where it's already hurting, which is at the late night TV shows. So it's the networks that are owned by studios who are going to feel the pressure the most first. And I would suggest in broadcast television, they're going to feel the pressure first. The streamers, who have a lot of money and a lot of banked projects, and they've been saying that they aren't going to hurt. Apple and Netflix, I have plenty of content.
They're
just going to sit, you know, you crank, you know, exactly churn it out. That's what worries me is, and also they haven't been through this before. So what's going to have to happen, and this happens every time, is eventually when things get really bad, and that could be 6 months from now. I'm not kidding. Yeah. When things get really bad and it's getting push come to shove time, that's when somebody emerges usually as a negotiator, some leader of the industry. You know, once it was Ken Ziffrin, the lawyer, once it was Jeffrey Katzenberg, you know, it could be someone like Bob Iger, who somehow comes to the table and brings everybody together and understands all the different issues from each side. And that's what would have to someone.
So an executive who can also speak to the concerns on the creative side, or at least acknowledge that they matter. I mean, one thing that's new about the negotiation this time that certainly wasn't coming up 15 years ago was AI, you know, the role of artificial intelligence in playing.
And they're really dangerously far apart.
And I don't know if
you've... Because the writers have to be in control of the AI. They have to be in control of it, or it's going to run amok.
I agree. I do have, because of new media is of tremendous interest to me, a lot of strong feelings about how this kind of technology is seen. And I think that the way in which the WGA is making certain demands for the technology needs to evolve, because basically what they're saying is that they don't want to be, they don't want AI generated content to be treated as literary content. So you're adapting something that, say, you use ChatGPT to create. The problem with that is that it's not just ChatGPT. AI is this ever evolving equation. Like, there's a program called Runway that's text to video, and that's ever evolved. So eventually you could get to the point where it's like you write a text prompt and something could create a, you know, like a rough cut of something. And then, you know, you just fill it in with actors or whatever. So like,
that could be
basically
helpful for people.
Yeah. I think the new frontier of creativity is learning how to use AI to create content,
but also how to control the rules around it.
Right. I think that if you're going to,
right now, it's a Wild West situation. I can see the studios. I get them. They're going to be, they're going to be going in there and ordering up scripts right away.
Right. Now. Well, I bet you the dirty little secret, a lot of screenwriters are messing around with this stuff, even if they don't want to admit
they're
it. Because
allowed
it's actually,
to. There's no reason why they shouldn't if it helps them, but they need to be given control of it.
That's the thing. I think responsible for it. I think that what the WGA should be asking for is any AI generated project needs to involve a WGA member in the initial, like if in ChatGPT is an interesting example.
The producer shouldn't be using it. They shouldn't be creating it. It right. has you, to be the writers.
Exactly. So writers need, I've been saying this to a lot of people, like the screenwriting professors need to be incorporating this kind of process into how they teach screenwriting. Cause it's just a new aspect of the process. And so they need to be asking for that. What the studios seem to be saying now is basically they'll agree to meeting periodically to talk about the technology.
That's complete bullshit.
Right. It's more like you need an overarching rule.
They want to be in control of it. That's what the studios want. And they're going to have to give that up because it won't work any other way.
But the demand needs to be basically broader than what there's. I think that the writers need to be basically saying any use of AI needs to involve the writer from the earliest stage.
Correct.
So, but we'll see what happens. I mean, I haven't been to any of these picket lines yet, but I'm curious to see how much noise they keep making. I mean, it is kind of like the Met Gala, right? It's a performance.
It's part of that. But the big rally that they had last night at the Shrine had an enormous number of people there, like 1,800 people showed up, and six of the guilds showed up to show solidarity. So if you start having situations where the IA and the DGA, which the DGA has and the AMTTP, the SAG-AFTRA have a June 30th deadline for their contracts. So we could get into a situation where, like, for example, Ryan Condal's season two of House of the Dragon is shooting in London right now, even though they're saying there's no work to be done on the
script. There's always writers get brought in to tweak things and stuff, so they can't do that.
He's the writer. He's the showrunner, but he shouldn't be writing anything. So that's an interesting situation. So I don't know if the different guilds are showing solidarity, they could hold up production completely.
Right. And I know we want to talk about the Academy made some rule changes, but one thing that's sort of relevant here is that you have a bunch of public events where people are supposed to be promoting work from Cannes to Emmy season.
Yeah. The Emmy season is, I was with someone last night who was involved in this. A lot of the writers are not participating. They're canceling their events.
Yeah.
They're not going to be doing any.
Yeah. They're not allowed to. It's part, they'd get kicked out of the WGA if they did. And at Cannes, the writers on you have Killers of the Flower Moon, you have Indiana Jones, you have Asteroid City, which is a really interesting question because somebody like Wes Anderson.
You could just say he's not participating in any press.
Right. Well, I'm sure he'd love that.
Which would be typical anyway,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. But it's an interesting kind of a question of, can Wes Anderson promote Asteroid City as director but not writer, as opposed to Roman Coppola, who is a co-writer? So I don't know if that's been
They'll just let the actors do the promoting, which I think would suit them just fine.
Yeah. But if this tips over into Oscar season with the fall, that'll be an interesting conundram.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Academy stuff, though, because so we've been anticipating these rule changes. And a few weeks ago, we talked about how there was, a leak of sorts that the Academy was talking about changing theatrical requirements. So we don't have that yet.
That was they decided to kick that can down the road, partly because they recognized that it would be controversial if they went for 22 cities and they went for, a wide release requirement. For these movies to be eligible for the Oscar, then they would be hurting by definition a lot of independent releases. And so I think they know that they have to sit down and do a much more thorough thinking through of all the issues, not only from the point of view of what they want to do to hit Netflix or to support theatrical, but from the point of view of what the optics would be.
Right. Because as you said, it hints at problems for lower budget movies that don't have the resources to get into all these markets and so forth. So nice of them to delay that one while they deal more directly with things that are easier to figure out, like the campaigning issue. So now it's unlikely we'll see Andrea Riseborough thing.
Right. Well, they definitely are trying to crack down, and they're saying they can only have, four hosted screenings in phase one and no hosted screenings in phase two. These are the events at people's homes with, Jessica Chastain, if she's not on Broadway, inviting people over to her house or whatever it is. So that isn't supposed to happen as often, and it isn't supposed to be paid for by the producers and distributors, and that is somewhat unenforceable. In other words, if it's an FYC event, they go through the Academy mailing list, and they're part of the Academy rules and they have to follow them, and they're letting lots of Q&As happen. That's not being restricted anymore. But if it's private and it's somebody's house, there's no Academy monitoring of that.
So everybody's going to be trying to call on each other.
Wild West.
You're going to have people though trying to say, ooh, that person broke the rules. And then there's going to be like all these like attempts at investigations and stuff. So I'm curious to see how that plays.
Let me just say this, that the Academy, in the history of all of this campaigning, people know what they can get away with.
And yeah,
they will
get away with it. No, but I did think it was interesting that they were very specific about you can't talk about who you voted for, and you can't talk to the press anonymously either. So we'll see how
they never were supposed to do that anyway. You know, I mean, if it's after the ballots have closed, it's a free world. You know, they can do whatever they want. It's been true for a long time. They weren't supposed to do it before. That's not brand new. But the other thing about what you can do online in social media and what you can talk about, I'm glad they're cracking down on that. They should. That's important.
Again, though, it's still sort of hard to police certain things, right? I mean, like how many...
But at least they've spelled it out. You know, you're not allowed to say that...
So-and-so should win over this person.
...has a worse chance of getting in than somebody else. You know, you're not allowed to talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's like social media is such a complicated beast, right? Like there could be... I mean, we had that thing with Michelle Yeoh right before voting closed where she posted a story that wasn't her story, but it pointed something out about Cate Blanchett versus her. And then she had to take it down. And I feel like stuff along
even
those
Janet
lines.
Yang, you know, they put in a rule that the governors aren't allowed to promote.
she definitely
had to take her promotion of Michelle Yeoh as well. So they're trying. It's pretty much the same old.
So the most surprising change was we were anticipating there would be discussion of the international rules, and we've talked a lot about kind of how problematic it is to have, you know, one country, one film, even if, say, you know, a country like Iran jails, you know, its best filmmakers, and then you're at the mercy of that country, or a country like India doesn't submit RRR, even though that's obviously the one that might win, or whatever.
Brazil or Russia, but these are countries that have, you know, government-run committees. You know, Putin gets involved in what they submit.
Year he didn't, because they didn't submit.
But the whole question of telling these committees that they have to be 50% filmmakers and craftspeople, I just think it's very
it's bold.
It's very direct of the Academy. Yeah. It matters to these countries to be in the Oscar race. They want to be, so that most of them are going to comply. But it's still up to who's the person who makes the final decision on that committee. That's who's going to call the shots. If they do change the group that picks the films.
I think what's also notable is that there's a full-time person overseeing this category now at the Academy, coordinating with different countries and helping them sort of get a handle on the process. And I think part of the challenge is that Europe...
What's the name? What's
Adilcia Barrera, who used to be at Sundance. But the big challenge is that you have a lot of countries that don't totally grasp the way this process works or how to do it right. There's so many different kinds of rules. It doesn't have to be in the language of your country and things like that. So you have, for example, Africa, where there are great filmmakers, but it often those countries don't get into the process. And if you had filmmakers as a part of that process, they might help sort of figure that out in a way where, as say, government officials might not be as you know, well attuned to the needs of their local communities. And so hopefully it shakes things up in that sense, that you're not just seeing the same kinds of films. I still feel like the biggest challenge is having just one country, one film is just like a limited perspective on the year in international cinema. But I don't know exactly how long it's going to take before that's really more broadly
addressed.
They're
going to keep tinkering and trying, you know, they want to make it better. You know, that's their goal. My question is, how do they enforce it? You know, does each country have to submit a list of who's on the committee?
Probably.
And so forth. And then they have to go over it and figure out who they are. I mean, that could take a long time. So that person is going to be very busy, I think, trying to monitor all of this.
Well, I'll be thinking about this at Cannes this year. We're 2 weeks out from that. Very few American films, but as we've seen, Cannes does really end up being this feeder of sorts for the international award season.
Every year, there's a list of films, and the Palme d'Or winner often gets in there. So they picked the jury.
They did.
I have to say, one person online was sort of like, ew, who is this jury? I think it's a very edgy jury. Interesting jury. Julia de Cornau is no slouch. And
well, yeah, her and Ruben Östlund are the two former Palme d'Or winners on the jury. And they're both not like the most, conventional.
No, the taste is there. And then you have Paul Dano, who's a very erudite fellow, an actor and director and writer. And so again, so is
Brie Larson.
Yeah.
So the two of them is a very interesting. You have, yeah. I mean, Brie Larson, I thought the movie that she directed a few years ago was solid. I can't quite get a grasp on her sensibilities. You know, like we start playing sort of like fantasy football of sorts with the Palme d'Or race, and it's you have no idea how things go. It's like I assume Julia de Cornau and Ruben Östlund are not gonna go for the
tearjerker
or whatever. But I remember our argument about, you know, like you called it when Ken Loach got the Palme d'Or for I, Daniel Blake, because it was like a very actor-centric jury. And then also that was the year of Tony Erdmann. And we found out later George Miller was not a huge fan of that movie. So like it was never going to happen there. But this year it's like, does this mean like somebody like Catherine Breillat with her, you know, transgressive sexual drama?
She's going to have a better shot with a different jury. But also Damon Cifron is a very interesting filmmaker. I love.
It's been a while since Wild Tales, and I know he had a hard. He was supposed to do a remake of Running Man that fell apart.
He's done some series, some TV series, and stuff like that. He's very successful. But he's got an edgy sensibility also. And he's funny. He is funny the way Östlund is funny. You know, very edgy.
Yeah, and you know, you have filmmakers like Jonathan Glazer, who has this A24 movie in competition that's about like an Auschwitz romance. It'd be interesting to see how somebody like that might sort of get a chance to another chance to sort of prove themselves after not working for a while, maybe differently than say a Nuri Bilge Ceylan or, you know, Ken Loach or Wim Wenders. There's a lot of people who are sort of like the old guard who have been respected and won prizes and all that kind of stuff. And then you have other people who, you know, it's a lot of people who are very established, but some who have been sort of appreciated more than others. So I'm curious about that. And I'm also curious about how any of this affects the market. I mean, last year with Triangle Sadness, it feels like ages ago, but that was a sales title. That was the big acquisitions title at Cannes. Neon ended up getting it.
The big one is now Todd Haynes' May December, which comes in with no, or over in the fortnight, the new Michel Gondry film would have some profile. But it's there's another movie, the Henry VIII movie.
Firebrand.
That one with Jude Law and Alicia Vikander, that's for sale too.
Yeah, the Firebrand. So it'll be interesting to see what happens on that front, because I mean, it's still no Netflix movies. I'm sure Netflix will be poking around. Apple will be poking around. Amazon is poking around.
They're going to look at the competition. Dreamers. They're going to look at acquisitions titles. There's going to be a lot of packages in the market. New movies that haven't been made yet that are being, you know, looking for some support from the North American side.
But the small companies are there too. And they will probably be looking at these,
speaking,
you know, art
of
prospects.
Which, you did a little research on IFC to see what the hell was going on over there. They've lost a couple of key players in the last few months, including Arianna Bacco, John Vanko. Tell me what's going on.
I mean, you might say they've lost all of the key players, at least based on, you know, what the company has been. It's a complete turnover. Scott Schumann, who's a veteran acquisitions guy at CBS,
been there a long time.
He's well known and liked in the industry, but he's new at IFC. Arianna had sort of brought him on board to run the acquisitions team during her tenure as president, and it is now sort of in this interim role. I think what the biggest challenge is that is basically similar to what IFC has faced in the past. And that is that it is part of AMC, and AMC has a lot of different brands, and it's a publicly traded company, and it runs these brands for profit. And it's very hard with these film art house films of this profile to kind of meet the demands of a company that's, you know, squeezed by, like a lot of other companies, the economics of streaming and so forth, and cut its workforce by 20%, as they said in their last earnings call. And then so that side of things has created a real challenge. And I think because they didn't staff up, this idea that IFC, as well as Shudder, which is its streaming horror brand, and RLJE, which is more kind of like B-movies, all being run as like a single unit in a way, has created real bandwidth issues. And that's frustrating to people, but it doesn't mean that IFC won't be a player. It can. I'm sure they're, you know, they will be there. They will be scouting for films, and they still have IFC centered. They still have the potential to do day and date and different kinds of options for films. It's just a question of, you know, with a new team, you know, are they going to make offers on films that are competitive when other people are sort of poking around as well? I mean, all the old school players are around, right? Magnolia is still there. Sony Pictures Classics is still.
Yeah.
Right. So it will be a good small scale market. Yeah. Kino Lorber. And of course, Sideshow, which is former IFC people, can pick up movies and do these sort of, you know, really incremental theatrical releases and that dovetail into streaming. That's what they did with EO. They're doing it now with Eight Mountains. So it's still a competitive market. It's just a very weird one because nobody really knows what succeeds now. The old rules of, you know, we'll just do the platform release and it'll dovetail into Oscar season.
They don't seem to have, what is their online component looking like? I mean, do they have a way to make money outside of theatrical? That was always my question.
Yeah, I mean, the economics of VOD are very confusing these days. I mean, it's AMC Plus is essentially the output deal that IFC has within its company outside of Shudder, which is a sort of niche streaming entity. So on the genre side of things, there is a kind of a business, but it's very unpredictable. It's very unstable. And so you can't make any hard promises about what kind of success something's going to have. I don't think this is just a challenge for IFC. I think it's a challenge for everyone. You know,
the studio distributors have output deals. They have different ways of getting PVOD and VOD up there.
Yeah, exactly. But like the bigger studios aren't necessarily going to go after a lot of these films. So you have still, you know, a Hulu output deal for certain companies like Neon and Magnolia.
Yeah.
And Searchlight as well, which we'll be scouting as well. So, you know, a lot of these films
has it puts its stuff up on VOD with it
and Peacock ultimately. Yeah. So the economics of streaming are still helping the art house market. We just don't know exactly what that means in terms of who has the upper hand in negotiations.
You liked Eight Mountains, as I recall.
I did. I saw it at Cannes last year. It's a very sort of tranquil, beautiful story, and it seems to be doing well in theatrical release, which makes sense because that's really the only way you can appreciate a movie set in the Italian Alps that is very visual like that. So,
well, I checked out the David Lowery Peter and Wendy, which was beautifully mounted. It's on Disney Plus. It's yet another story on Peter Pan and Wendy, and it isn't entirely successful because Peter Pan himself isn't entirely successful, which is a slight problem. But Captain Hook and everyone else are fantastic.
You can't go wrong with Jude Law, Captain Hook, right? I mean, it's a nice way to set the stage for him in this Cannes movie as Henry.
Well, how would you identify the problem with Peter Pan on that?
I think it's just a very traditional. You mean the challenge, overall challenge of dealing with Peter Pan or with this particular one?
No, this particular one.
I mean, this one is I didn't mind it. I just found it to be very conventional.
Very familiar. Yeah.
It's just familiar. And I suppose for a certain younger demographic who isn't familiar with Peter Pan, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And maybe that's what Disney wanted.
I'm sure it is.
It made me think about how much I actually respected what Ben Zeitlin did with Wendy, a very strange and outside the box interpretation of the Peter Pan story that I think deserves a second look. deserves a second look.
This is way more successful. Way more. And Lowry just has control over his craft. I mean, it's just gorgeously wrought, you know, it's well done.
All right, Anne. Well, enjoy your weekend. If I don't see you on a picket line, I'll see you on the podcast.
Okay. See you later.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.